This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert. This is Allegro Non Troppo, broadcast in Melbourne on radio station 3JOY and across Australia on the Community Radio Network, presented by Adam Stobbs
and Peter Forty.
Today we're going to tackle the very thorny and very emotive issue of abortion.
The legislation of abortion is a sensitive issue fraught with strong and opposing opinions. Lobby groups from the church and right to lifers against those seeking the right to legal abortions attempt to influence legislative decisions which can affect many people. Whichever way the argument goes, it will cause anger and frustration for some. How much right does someone have to influence the decisions of those closely involved? In their desire to get their opinions heard, do some lose sight of the needs of those going through the trauma of an unwanted pregnancy? To help us try to make sense of this minefield of opinion are former Senator and leader of the Australian Democrats, Lynn Ellison, and bioethicist, researcher, writer and commentator, Dr. Leslie Canold.
Dr. Leslie Canold is a bioethicist, a researcher and writer and commentator and honorary fellow at the School of Philosophy, Anthropology and Social Inquiry at the University of Melbourne. She's honorary senior lecturer at the Centre for Gender and Medicine at Monash University, and Leslie is a member of the ethics panel of the Infertility Treatment Authority, the statutory authority responsible for administering Victoria's Infertility Treatment Act in 1995. She's president of the Reproductive Choice Australia, a national coalition of pro-choice individuals and organisations that early in 2006 played a key role in removing the effective ban on RU486. She's also a spokesperson for Pro-Choice Victoria. Welcome to the show, Dr. Canold.
Thank you very much for having me.
Look, I'm really grateful for you coming on because this is a really, really difficult issue. And it's one of these issues that causes a great deal of emotion in the community. Can you tell us a little bit about your position? Now, I've had a good look through your website, and it's hyperlinked to the Allegro webpage for if our listener would like to have a look at allegro.org.au. Tell us just a little bit. Now, I got in touch with you through Mari Stopes International.
That's right, and that's because Mari Stopes International is one of the coalition partners for Pro-Choice Victoria. So at the moment in Victoria, we're having a battle, really, about whether or not we're going to finally succeed in pulling abortion out of the Crimes Act. So at the moment, there's a lot of activity and a lot of coalitions being formed, and Mari Stopes is just one of the partners that's part of this coalition called Pro-Choice Victoria, and we're just fighting to hopefully get a law that as much as possible enables women, and if they have partners, their partners, to make decisions for themselves about when and if they have children, which to us is just a very, very common sense position, and of course the position of the majority. So while I agree with you that there are, it often appears in the media as though this is a highly contested issue. In fact, if you look at the numbers, I once had a politician say to me, on any other issue, 81% of people supporting something, which in this case is supporting a woman's right to choose, is a no-brainer. But because the minority, and it's about somewhere between 4 and 9% of people, always oppose safe and legal abortion, no matter what the reasons are, so even in cases of rape and incest, even in cases where a woman's life may be at risk if she continues a pregnancy, they always oppose termination because they do feel so strongly about it. It's very much grounded in religious views, so even though the vast majority of people who are religious are in fact pro-choice, nearly everybody who is pro-life or anti-abortion, whatever you want to call them, nearly all of them are religious. So they are very strongly held views. They're grounded in views about God and about who really has the right to control what happens to our lives. So for people who are believers, often that it isn't really our right to decide if we're going to have a pregnancy. It isn't our right to decide if we're going when and if we're going to die, if we have a serious illness. Yep. Those people do feel very, very strongly about it.
Right. So that's, we've got a sort of a statement from Dr. Leslie Canold. The other person joining us on Allegro Non Troppo for us to take us through this issue, and it's, and the reason I've asked this person, and she's one of the people I trust the most on this issue, somebody who's been on our show quite a bit, and if I was going to ever touch this subject, I would want to do it with her guidance. And it's former Senator Lynn Allison, and I've got her here because she's consistently through her whole life tackled hard issues head on and not ignored them. I just wanted to read you something I got out of the Sydney Morning Herald this week by Eric Jensen. This will tell you what Lynn Allison is like for those people who don't know her. This is out of the Sydney Morning Herald by Eric Jensen, and it was the 20th of August. The former leader of the Australian Democrats, Lynn Allison, began proceedings with an argument for democracy in place of religion, the first affirmative case for the world being better without religion. So it looks as though she was speaking in a debate. Bible was a cruel text in her reading, dependent on complex and outdated myths, a fosterer of cults that had protected pedophiles, church teaching had fueled AIDS and repressed women, she argued. Global warming was an Armageddon ignored by the leaders, including Cardinal George Pell, the Catholic Archbishop of Sydney, but one which would need more than an ark to be avoided. Organized religion still bears no responsibility for its extremism and the problems its dictators have created, Miss Allison said. Religion absolves people from the blame or the need to fix anything. Lynn Allison addressed the issue of RU486 abortion drug and has campaigned hard for the rights of women and indeed for all Australians in her position as leader of the Democrats. Welcome to Allegro, Lynn Allison.
Thank you so much.
I hope you didn't mind me reading that from the Sydney Morning Herald. That was, when I read that, I thought I could just see Lynn Allison doing that.
Yeah, yes, it was a very small précis of quite a long piece, and of course our debate was, would we be better off without religion? So I opened the case for the affirmative, and of course you've got to go in tough when you do that.
It sounds very much like Richard Dawkins' approach to the whole thing. So our two guests to talk with us on abortion today are Dr. Leslie Canold and Senator Lynn Allison. There's a couple of things about the abortion debate. There are three main issues that affect community attitudes to abortion. The first one is stereotyping. Women who have abortions are this sort of person. The second one is prejudice, that we have attitudes that abortion is wrong. And the third one is discrimination. The three things, I think, are stereotype, prejudice and discrimination. Peter, where have we heard this before?
Well, I guess it comes up in all sorts of debates.
Gay and lesbian people.
Indeed.
The three things that we face in our lives that affect our community, stereotyping, prejudice and discrimination. Lynn Allison, would you like to comment on this?
Yes. I think that's right. Whether it's women in general who are in a lesser power position than men in society, in almost every field you can point to, or whether it is a small group who offend religion in some way, and I'm not talking about all religion. As Leslie says, there are a lot of people who hold religious views who are more than happy for women to have choice in the matter of abortion. So it's the extreme end of the spectrum that we're talking about here, and I think that women in this situation, or gay people, or any other marginalised group, will often find themselves at odds with that position.
Leslie Canold, what do you think? Stereotyping, prejudice, discrimination?
Oh, look, I love that analysis, only because I suppose one of the things that always really strikes me in this debate is that I try to spend a lot of time, and I know that Lynn does too, talking about how the law should be for us. So we include ourselves as women who are reproductive, and we know that the vast majority of people who are going to be affected by these laws. So we like to talk about the 96 to 97% of people who will face a problem pregnancy very early on in the pregnancy, and we want to ask the question, who should decide? But often there is that tendency from the other side to say, let's talk about the really hard cases. Let's talk about, you know, the tiny 0.7% of people who are having a termination past, say, 20 or 24 weeks, because we want to talk about those people over there, not us. And I do think it's really important when we talk about the kind of laws we want to govern us with regard to reproduction that we remember that one in three Australian women will actually have a termination in her lifetime. These are the same women who, you know, you sit next to at work, the same women who you sit next to in the tram, your mother, your aunt. It's us. And so I think it's really important when we think about the laws, we try to imagine what would it be like for us to be in this situation, as you say, walk around in someone's shoes and imagine this is happening to us as someone we love, and imagine a politician or Margaret Tai, who runs Right to Life Australia here in Victoria, telling us what we should do, what's right and necessary in our situation.
The community, the pro-life community, have really been quite insidious the way that they propagate their views. Now, I'm trying to take a really objective viewpoint on this, but it's really difficult. It's one of these things, this issue is very hard to be objective, but I'm trying. So I had a look on the internet for some stories about abortion to see what I could find, and one of the most popular ones is the Yahoo website, where people post a question and then the answers are put up. And then the people who read it vote for the best answer that they think most describes the process. And I'm going to read this one out because this one absolutely devastated me. And this is a woman who said, "Now, I believe this is a lie, but I'll read it to you because this is the sort of language that goes out." And this quite upset me. So this is a young woman's experience when she went for an abortion. She said, "I stood at the doctor's side and watched him perform a partial birth abortion on a woman who was 6 months pregnant. The baby's heartbeat was clearly visible on the ultrasound screen. The doctor delivered the baby's body and arms, everything but his little head. The baby's body was moving, his little fingers were clasping together, he was kicking his feet. The doctor took a pair of scissors and inserted them in the back of the baby's head, and the baby's arms jerked out in a flinch, a startled reaction, like a baby does when he thinks he might fall. The doctor opened the scissors up, stuck in the high-powered suction tube in the hole, and sucked the baby's brains out. Now the baby was completely limp. I never went back to the clinic, but I'm still haunted by the face of that little boy. It was the most perfect angelic face I have ever seen." When you see stuff like that, it really, really does grab at the emotional heartstrings. But from the other things that I've read, there is absolutely no way that could be true.
Oh, well done for you.
Because
first of all, just try and imagine, who is this person who gets invited into the private surgery of someone else's procedure and just gets to stand there and somehow gets to see the face of something that's actually inside the body of another person? They must have X-ray vision. But of course, you can't take this stuff too literally. And I think sometimes your point is the right one, which is that this stuff is designed to grab the emotion. And if I spend a lot of time analysing how this couldn't really be true, and a lot of stuff that gets said, there's no documentation for it. You know, there's no publication in peer-reviewed journals. It just gets said and it gets out there and it's designed to grab the emotion. So the point really, what it's designed to do, is focus you not on the story of the woman. So we don't know anything about why this woman might be seeking a termination at 6 months is so, so rare. The most common reason why it would be happening is because there would be a very much wanted pregnancy where there's been a diagnosis of something terribly catastrophically wrong with the fetus. So that's the common story.
Yes.
But the objective of the people who are trying to make us feel that there's something terrible and awful and wrong and shameful about termination is to try to make that woman invisible, try to make her story invisible, her reasons invisible, her anguish invisible, the consultation she did with her doctor, the pain she suffered, the discussion she had with her boyfriend, all of that disappears, and we're just focused on something that's being called a baby, which in fact, unless you disregard pregnancy as being meaningful at all, and people who are on the other side of the argument do. So they say that the minute the sperm swims into an egg, you have something that has the same moral value as you or me. There's no difference between that conceptus and a person with all the moral standing that we understand human beings to have, because pregnancy doesn't matter and birth doesn't matter. Now, you ask a woman, does pregnancy and birth matter? She thinks it matters a lot. But it's all part of the propaganda to make us not look at the woman and her story and her reasons, because that will engender our sympathy usually.
That's the reason. Yes. That's the reason why I read this, is because it uses this language. But the other thing, the important point I wanted to make by reading that, is this was voted by the users of the Yahoo website as the best answer or description of abortion. It's obviously not so. There's a huge political movement. It's a huge movement from the Right to Life people to completely undermine women's choices. Lynn Allison, what did you think of all of that, this particular issue of the pro-life people using language like this?
Look, we can recognise those techniques. So when I had my office in East Melbourne, just up from the day procedure clinic, which did quite a number of terminations, there were protesters outside, and they invariably had a big plastic replica of a baby in utero, gory images of fetuses and so forth, and that's really to express what they want us to read from this, is that this is a very violent thing to do, and should be opposed. So it's a classic way of trying to bring in the sympathy there.
I'd like to read something I got from AdelaideNow.com, and this appeared on February the 8th, 2006. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll read this part, and this will probably put it in, and I don't wish to put you on the spot, Lynn Allison, but I think this is important. Democrat leader Lynn Allison, who co-sponsored the bill, told Parliament an estimated 1 in 3 women have had an abortion, and I'm one of those. It's a galling listening to the men, and it's mostly men, who have such contempt for women who terminate unwanted pregnancies, who have neither the compassion nor the understanding for the huge and for many daunting tasks of taking an embryo the size of a grain of rice to adulthood. That's quite a thing that you came out and said, Lynn Allison. You said this in the Senate?
Yes, I did. It was part of the debate on RU486 and removing the minister's power of veto over the TGA's approval of that drug.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that with the rest of Australia. That's a really important statement.
Well, can I say, a lot of people have said to me that was a really courageous thing to do, and I don't see it that way. I think that... For many women who've had this experience, they're encouraged to feel ashamed of it, make it a very private matter, and until we start looking at the figures and discover it is 1 in 3, and as Leslie says, it's your aunt, it's your grandma, it's your cousin, it's your, you know, it's very hard not to be surrounded by women who've had this experience. And yet the fact that this moved so many women suggested to me that they'd been frightened, felt guilty about what had happened to them, to the extent that they were unwilling to talk about it. Now, I don't want all women out there to be running around talking about this. It is a private matter. There's no question about that. But I thought it was important for me as someone who had initiated this legislation to state very clearly where I was coming from, just reduce a bit of the anonymity to the whole question.
And Lynn, wasn't one of the things though that happened after you did that, because it was, I agree with you that in some ways it shouldn't have to be seen as such a brave thing because it's such a common experience, and yet you did put a face on the story. It wasn't one of the things that happened was that instead of all those men in the chamber, mostly men, because there was a huge gender split along this vote with regard to RU486, very few women voted against, the removal of the minister's veto power, was that it stopped people, again, kind of talking about those terrible women. Like, it wasn't all that many years ago, it was just back in 1998, that a senator or a MLC, I can't remember, somebody, a parliamentarian, stood up in the WA Parliament and said the reason women had terminations was because they wanted to look good in bikinis. So
yes.
It was a capacity to sort of pretend that nobody in the chamber, none of the women in there, really had this experience, and you could talk about those women, those callous, careless, selfish, heartless women. And all of a sudden Lynn said, well, wait a minute, if you're going to say all those things, if you're going to spew hate and all of the misogyny that really is out there about women and what we're like if we're not good women, you know, good virginal, good maternal women, say it to my face. And I thought it was an incredibly powerful thing. Do you feel like it changed how people were speaking in that room?
Yes, I think it did. And it was amazing that the thousands of people who contacted me about that, you know, I can't remember any that were negative except some of the religious fundamentalists said, we feel sorry for you and you hope you repent and so forth. But the vast majority said it moved them. And one woman, I'll never forget this, one woman told me that she'd had a termination when she was quite young, but she had a very close relationship with her daughter, who was now in her mid-20s, but never been able to tell her about this experience, and was anxious about that. She felt she was able to share all sorts of other important mother-daughter things, but not this. And so she went out as a result of what I had said and told her daughter, and that this made an enormous difference to both their relationship and to her sense of not covering anything up. So
the other thing that happened when you did during this time is probably one of the most outrageous things I've ever seen in Parliament that offended me beyond belief, was Tony Abbott coming out and saying that he could not sanction the use of RU486 because of his religious beliefs. How dare he bring his personal prejudices and force them onto all Australians? That was probably, I've never been so offended in my life by a politician's statement as that.
Yes, and of course a health minister at the time was very powerful. The message got through to the pharmaceutical industry that the minister would not look kindly on them, and of course the industry is dependent on government for getting their product onto the PBS and for approval of its use in this country, and there are subtle ways in which powerful people can influence the process.
Yes.
You don't need to be direct about this. You just need to make it clear, like coming out and saying, you know, not under my watch.
Well, thank goodness that they removed his power of veto. And it all went
ahead. But what he's managed to do, and I think Tony Abbott, you know, you'd have to use the word claim credit in careful quotation marks there, but I think he can claim credit for driving this issue back into the centre of the agenda. So, I mean, I'm in my 40s, and I've now spent most of my kind of past 10 years in terms of being an activist around this issue, and I guess I would have told you if I was in my 20s that that's what I was going to be doing. I would have thought the issues for women of my generation, we should have been fighting about the work-family balance, we should have been fighting about parental leave. We thought we were going to be able to move on, that this was the issue that my mother's generation fought and had won, and yet it has been such a successful kind of counter-push, and I suppose it always is two steps forward, one step back. But for me, it's been a very painful step back to have watched, you know, women my age and having to activate younger women to fight on an issue where younger women are something like 90% of them are pro-choice. So for them, this is just a complete non-issue, no-brainer. And it's hard, therefore, to activate them only because they just think, what? Like, are we still talking about this? This is such an old issue. I want to be talking about climate change. I want to be talking about there's so many other things we could be fighting for, and yet here we are stuck back fighting for this same old issue. I think it's a huge frustration.
And Adam, if I can add to that, it's not just abortion. It's the whole reproductive health arena.
Yes.
So there has not been a new oral contraceptive put on the PBS in the last 12 years. Family planning spending as part of our overseas aid budget has dropped from 0.44%, which was low enough, it ought to be about 10%, dropped from 0.44% to 0.07%, so just one-sixth of what it was 12 years ago.
If we had more effective contraceptives, and they were more available, and they were more reliable, and they were less side effects, possibly would there be less need for abortion?
Well, that's true, and this is especially the case for oral contraceptive, because now there are much more sophisticated versions of oral contraceptive, which are, you know, but you know, women who are on relatively low incomes can only afford the ones that are subsidised by the PBS.
And there is no question that link exists. So that's not a conjecture on your part, even though obviously it's kind of common sense. There's clear research that shows if if you want to reduce the abortion rate, and this seems the one thing that, you know, no matter what politician you get up to talk about termination, it's the one thing they'll say is we don't want the abortion rate to go up. And yet we act as though somehow we have no idea how it is that you would lower the abortion rate. It's completely obvious how you lower the abortion rate. Every bit of research shows that you lower the rate of unwanted pregnancy, because then you're working with women, because when they don't want to be pregnant, that's what an unwanted pregnancy is. They don't want to be pregnant. So if you help them to achieve what they themselves want to achieve, which is not being pregnant when they don't want to be pregnant, you win-win. You don't have to oppress women. You don't have to try to make them feel guilty, stigmatize them, deny them a safe legal procedure that they've made their own decision they want, and either, you know, drive them to further delay or drive them to a backyard termination. It's all so silly. You just need to start at the beginning point, which is help women to do what they don't want to, what they want to achieve in the first place. They don't want to be pregnant. So let's get some comprehensive, intelligent reproductive health care out there, sex education, all of the things that we're terribly backwards about, and then we have the gall to complain later when you have a higher rate of unplanned pregnancy than other countries where they do this sort of thing. Then we have the gall to try to deny women a safe and legal service and to make them feel guilty. It's just, it's really not morally sound to do it that way.
Okay, I think we get there.
If I could just say, put a personal point of view here. I was born in the mid-40s, and in those days, of course, abortion was not done except in back streets or whatever. I know my birth mother almost certainly would have had me aborted if the ability to have abortions was, it was easier to get abortions. I'm glad she didn't, because she adopted me out. And if I was in that situation today, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be here. You know, so I know this is an emotional side of it, but it's a very real one to me. And this is one of the reasons why I find it very difficult to make a clear-cut decision between pro and anti-abortion.
Can I offer something about that, just from a philosophical perspective? Mm-hmm. There are a couple of things that are really important to remember about that, which is that, of course, once you're a person who is born, and now you're an adult, intelligent, thinking, rational person, of course you value your own life, and you think, oh, I'm really glad that I have my life. But when a termination is being contemplated by the vast, vast majority of people, it's being contemplated on a creature that's not even fully formed yet, little less has the capacity to think and value its own life and therefore be hurt by the taking of its life and the taking of all its opportunities. So it's kind of one of those counterfactual things that when you get people who are alive and rational and thinking about whether or not they would have liked to have been terminated, of course they wouldn't want that. But when you're thinking about the way termination really takes place, what you're ending is the life of something that's important, no doubt, to that woman, because it's something that could become her child. And of course, once it's no longer could, but in fact is a child, everything changes in terms of what our obligations are to that creature. And as that creature grows and becomes a rational thinking human being, everything changes in terms of thinking about termination, but of course it does. But what we're talking about is something that if you'd never been born, you never would have had the capacity to have regretted not being born. Is that too confusing, or does that make sense?
Well, doesn't it come down to the philosophical opinion of whether you consider a fetus as being a non-entity, basically, or has the potential to become a human being?
But
the value you put on the fetus, how you see the fetus, is what I mean. It's a philosophical point of view, isn't it?
Well, I think in some ways the debate is about whether or not we frame it that way. So certainly the people, there's one way of framing it that says, yes, it's all about whether or not we grant that the fetus has personhood and when we grant that it has a personhood. There's certain things that are unquestioned. So nobody would question that when the vast majority of terminations are taking place very early in pregnancy, the creature that we're talking about, it doesn't have a consciousness. It doesn't have the capacity to value its own life. So that's all I was saying. I certainly wasn't saying it is a meaningless entity, although my view would be that the reason it has meaning is not or in this abstract way of, you know, is it a potential life? Of course it's a potential life. Is it a human being? Of course. It's not a virus. It's not a slug. It's not an a possum. It's a human. But the question is whether or not it is already too late at the point when it's still this, as Lynn says, this tiny grain of rice-sized being in a woman's body, very much in her body, whether or not it's too late for her to say, if this creature were to become a human being, and this is the research that I've done where women will say this, if I am going to become a mother, I want to be a good mother. I want to parent this child well. I want to be in a stable relationship. I want to not be on welfare. I want to be able to offer it, you know, all the opportunities. And I can't do that right now because I'm 14 years old or because I'm in a violent relationship and my partner has told me if I have a child, he's going to leave me. Or I already have three children and one of them has a disability and so I can't possibly have another child now and give it everything I want. So women terminate not because the fetus doesn't matter to them. They terminate because it matters so much, because it's going to be, if it's born, their child, and they want to offer it everything. And because they can't, they say, it's not too late for me to responsibly say, I can't do this, so I'm going to have a termination. They see it as taking responsibility.
Okay, I think we get that, and I think we're with you.
Can I just add to that? If you take this argument to a logical extension, you might also say, well, if my parents had used contraception, I wouldn't be here now at the time that I was conceived. So I think if you have to look at it in that light.
I could argue that point.
And the other thing I'd like to add is if we say that, you know, that the fertilized egg is now an entity, well, then perhaps you say the same thing about ova and sperm. They're living things. You know, it's
that are potentially
going to be human beings. So,
they haven't been a fertilizer.
Let's not go down that track because we could spend all day talking about that.
You'll spend years.
Yes. This is Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Our special guests, Dr. Leslie Connold and Lynn Allison.
You're listening to Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network.
Abortion is a reality in Australia and in Victoria, and the reason we're having this conversation on the Community Radio Network with Allegro Non Troppo, with Leslie Connold and Lynn Allison, is the fact that there is a current bill to decriminalisation in Victorian Parliament. The Victorian Women's Affairs Minister Maxine Morand has put forward a bill, and any woman who wants an abortion during the first 24 weeks of pregnancy will be able to lawfully get one. Such abortions will be regulated like any other medical procedure, Ms. Moran told Parliament. Abortion where the woman is 24 weeks pregnant or less will be a private decision for a woman in consultation with her medical practitioner. To deal with the highly sensitive issues of late-term abortion, the bill puts extra conditions on women who want to terminate their pregnancy after 24 weeks. One of the things I wanted to ask Lynn Allison and Leslie Connold about on this issue is there is some debate about counselling. That the situation, as I'm understanding at the moment, is that they're saying that they want mandatory counselling for women before they have abortions. Have I read this right?
Yes. Well, the federal government funds counselling for pregnancy to the tune of, I think it's about $65 million from memory, and that has largely not been taken up because for the most part women don't consider they need counselling about making the decision. Some do and some are undecided, there's no question about that, and for some counselling is useful even if they have made the decision. So imposing counselling suggests that women don't actually know what they're doing, which is ludicrous.
Yep.
that they don't understand the implications. I think it's very demeaning and very, you know, the message is very strong that women are not fully human, okay, not fully able to make their own decisions, and they need the help of someone who can.
Can I put a couple of parallels in my own life? My partner died in 1995, and yeah, it was a traumatic time, but after about a year, I got over it. You know, I was okay. My partner was dead. I was moving on with my life. I started to get migraine headaches, and things were not working out pretty well in my life. And the number of people that I went to see, a couple of counsellors and things, they all were obsessed that I was having delayed grief. I wasn't. I was over it. There were other things going on in my life. And I went to three counsellors. One of them was really, really good. And we've had him on this show, John Ball, before. But the rest of them were all completely obsessed that I was going through delayed grief. And that was not the case. But they could not see past the fact that I'd been through this traumatic experience, and that's why my life, and this sounds like the same sort of thing, everybody's assuming women are going to have huge problems with abortion, so we need to make them have counselling.
And most of them are just relieved that it's over, they're out of trouble, okay, they don't have to face this situation. Which,
can I counterpose this with my personal experiences? I've had a bit to do with abortion. I've been a teacher for a lot of years, and because of the style of teaching I do, I stay in touch with my students after I've taught them. And in 1995, just before my partner died actually, one of my ex-students rang me at 7:45 in the morning, and she was at the family planning clinic in East Richmond, and she said, "Mr. Stobbs, I'm at the family planning clinic, I'm here to have an abortion, and I haven't got my credit card's not accepted. Can you help me?" And I thought, my God, what have I... I didn't have time to argue the issues of abortion. All I thought was, Anne, this was the girl's name. It's not actually a real name, but Anne is in trouble. She needs my help. I'll go and help her. And I went down to the family planning clinic. The first thing that I did, I parked the car, raced out trying to find it, and I thought, didn't have to look very far. Here's all of these people with placards and chanting out the front, telling me off for going inside. I went inside and I had a checkbook, and they said they'd take my check. There were a lot of women there. There were a lot of people there. And I'm writing out this check for Anne's abortion, and I suddenly thought, my God, I looked around, they're looking at me. I said, it wasn't me. I'm not the father, I'm just paying for it. But that that experience for me, going there, doing that, was terribly traumatic. So what was it like for poor Anne? It must have been hideous.
But I think what's really important is to kind of get some sort of balance in all of this, because the reality is that, you know, obviously women are all individuals, and so everyone will have a different individual reaction, yes, to every experience they have. But for most women, the crisis is the unwanted pregnancy. Right. So the crisis is, I am pregnant, I didn't plan to be pregnant, I don't want to be pregnant. As Lynn says, 75% of women don't want counselling because they are able, through the variety of networks that they already have, to make a decision. It's not a pathological situation. You're not sick or ill or disturbed or deranged if you are upset about the fact that something has happened to you, something very big and important that you didn't want to happen. Yeah. Of course you're upset, of course you're distressed, but for the vast majority of women, it becomes clear quite quickly what they want to do. Some, of course, go on and parent. A very, very, very tiny percentage will choose to continue and then adopt, and then another percentage will choose to terminate. And as Lynn says, for those women who choose to terminate, the most common response, and it is, you know, the overwhelming response, is that women feel relief.
Well,
and when
so
they go back and are asked later, would you have done the same thing again? Again, nearly all of them say yes. Now, does that make abortion a happy experience? No, because being pregnant when you don't want to be pregnant is not a happy experience. And none of the outcomes, if you didn't want to be in that situation, are happy. It's not happy to parent an unwanted child. It's not happy to have to give away a child who you've gestated and given birth to. And abortion isn't a joyous experience either. Unfortunately, having a pregnancy when you don't want to be pregnant is not all that happy.
They're very good points, Leslie Kennold. Let me say the outcome of that one is Anne had the abortion. I had problems dealing with it, but I came round fairly well. She was fine. She came back to my place, and afterwards, and she was fine, and she got on with her life, like starting the next day, and there was no huge issue about it. But I have had other students. I have one in particular that I'll never forget. She had an abortion probably 30 years ago. I didn't find out till some years later that she told me that she'd had it. And this is 30 years ago, and she still agonizes over it this day. So what I've gathered from that is she just shouldn't have had it. She wasn't mature enough to be having sex in the first place. She obviously wasn't ready for to have sex. She wasn't ready for to be pregnant. She wasn't ready for an abortion. And she's never ever got over it for that reason. And she's had that much counselling. I just have to say, subsequently, she's had two other children that were born, and both of them were born with a drug habit. So
I think one of the most interesting research findings I've ever seen is the one that shows that in terms of women's emotional recovery after termination, if they're living in an environment, like many of us will be or know the fact that in places like Russia and China, abortion is not stigmatized. It's just seen as part of the array of, you know, for right or for wrong, array of ways in which women manage their fertility and only have the children that they want. In those places where it's not stigmatized, there is virtually no such thing as post-abortive stress, or whatever you'd want to call that kind of long-term negative experience. It barely ever happens, even in our culture. But of course, partially what's happening is that the anti-choice rhetoric about how terrible abortion is, and women, if they ring up the wrong kind of places to get support, if they do want to get help with their decision making, this small percentage that do, they're most likely to blunder their way into speaking to a pro-life agency. They won't know it. They'll think, because the advertising is not honest, that this is a all-options pregnancy counseling service.
I found that this week when I've been researching the number of pro-life ones that disguise themselves as pro-choice.
It's terrifying. And so for that woman, she can very well end up at the end of it all feeling terrible, but it's not because intrinsically there's something problematic with termination. But if you ring up somebody, you think that they're a legitimate counselor, that they will actually provide accurate information about and support for referral for all three options. But the truth is that they're pro-life, and that their own religious views mean that they cannot give you accurate information about abortion or support a referral for abortion. Then they will listen to you, and this is what they do, and I can't think of anything more immoral than this, but they will listen to you and they will hear what you're saying. Well, you know, look, I know that I want to have a termination. I'm only 16. My boyfriend and I are definitely, you know, not ready to have a child. But what I'm worried about is that I might never be able to have another child again. And the pregnancy counselor will listen to that and say, absolutely, you know, abortion's going to make you infertile. Now, that's just a blatant falsehood. There is no medical truth to that whatsoever. And it is also just a great evil to pretend that what you're offering is a legitimate counseling service, when actually what you're doing is listening to someone's vulnerabilities and then turning them back around right on them. So if they say, what I'm worried about is that I'm going to go to hell, the counselors say, absolutely. You know, look, I hate to tell you this, but if you have a termination, you're going to go to hell. Well, yeah, some women are probably going to end up pretty traumatized after they have a termination listening to that.
In Victoria, the best estimate suggests that there's 20,000 abortions, terminations every year. That works out at about 55 a day. The current bill that's coming up before Parliament is to decriminalise. It's not to approve or sanction, it's to decriminalise abortions. They're already happening all over Australia. The only place in Australia where that's actually already decriminalised is the ACT.
That's great.
Yeah. So Victoria will be the first if this bill goes ahead. The bill has been brought in by Maxine Morand, Mr. Brumby, and Mr. Baillieu, that's the Premier and the Leader of the Opposition, have both come out in support. Daniel Andrews, Bronwyn Pike, Jacinta Allen, Tim Pallas have declared their support, but James Molino, Theo Theophanous, and Robert Clark, surprise, surprise, have come out against it. The AMA, the Australian Medical Association, will write to all MPs asking them to support the bill, saying it would not affect the number of abortions. The research I've done during the week has stated from the World Health Organization that whether abortions are decriminalised, legal, or readily available, it doesn't seem to make any difference to the number of abortions being performed. Can you comment on that, please, Leslie Lynn?
Well, that's just, again, a simple fact. we know that we know from our own, just think about our own history, backyard termination. I mean, it was illegal and the law was actually enforced, and women still, if they decided that they needed a termination, they would risk their fertility and even their lives, and sometimes they did die in order to get a termination. So that we know the law has no impact on the number. All it does is impact the suffering and degree of trauma that the woman has to undertake to have a termination. If you want to lower the rate, you have to lower the rate of unplanned pregnancy.
We're running out of time. I've got a couple of other important questions I want to ask you and Lynn Allison. Your perspective as pro-life people, pro-choice people, what is the role of men in abortions? How do you see men?
Oh, do you want me to take that, Lynn?
Yeah. Yes, thanks.
Listen, I actually just wrote something about this, so it's right top of the mind at the
moment. Actually, I've read it.
look, my view about it, I mean, it's a complex view, and I'd have to take you through the argument and take too long here. But the upshot of what I think is I think it's useful. You were talking before about the conscience vote and about how there's going to be, you named, you know, three men who are not going to vote in favor of decriminalization.
Yes.
And I guess for me, there's something quite galling about somebody saying, it's so important, this is such an important issue, I must be able to exercise my conscience on this issue, and then use that freedom to deny a woman her capacity to act on her conscience. So I think we have to keep in mind that this is a health issue for women, no doubt about it, but it also has moral implications for people, and it is very important that we respect that people need to be able to control what happens to their own bodies and their own lives. Now,
okay.
When it comes to men, you can't have half an abortion and you can't have half a pregnancy. So it's impossible to compromise at the end of the day about what kind of a decision gets made. And because it's happening in a woman's body, ultimately she has to make the decision.
Okay, that's fair enough, Leslie Kennell. Lynn Allison?
And if I can add to that, you ask what the role of men is. I think there is, for a substantial number of women, a big factor when it comes to men. I think women are far less likely to terminate a pregnancy if their partner, the father of the pregnancy, says, yes, I want you to have this child, and yes, I will be around for raising it. I will assist you in doing that, and I will even be a good husband, or I'll be a whatever, and be convincing in saying that. I think there are a lot of women who terminate pregnancies who'd rather not, because they can't see a future with this man, but for a whole range of reasons.
Yep.
So I think there is a role here with men, I think that the part of the problem is that men have not taken responsibility for some of the unwanted pregnancies that are out there. I'll never forget Alan Cadman, Member of Parliament, who said he couldn't understand why women were going out willy-nilly getting pregnant.
Yes, silly willy-nilly, wasn't it?
Yeah. as if men had no role in that, in whether or not that sexual encounter became a pregnancy. So I think there's a role, but it's about prevention of unwanted pregnancy as much as anything.
Look, the last thing I wanted to do was draw a couple of parallels here between the gay and lesbian community and the issues we face and that women face with on this issue of termination of pregnancy. It's about choice. You now have the ability to choose whether you terminate your pregnancy or not. We don't have any choice in whether we want to have a recognised relationship or not. We can't get married. We don't have that choice. A lot of gay men say they don't want to get married, and the reason they don't want to get married is they've never had the ability to choose. We've never been given a choice, and we still don't, and it's unlikely to happen. So when our community thinks, oh, maybe this topic has got nothing to do with the gay and lesbian community, there are parallels of issue, the issue of choice. Lynn Allison and Leslie Cunnell, thank you very much for joining us on this special edition of Allegro Non Troppo. How did we go? How did we go? Did we cover the issue, do you think?
We'd probably need about 5 hours to do that really thoroughly. But I think we've got across some of the key issues and the key points of view.
Yeah, so it's a terrific opportunity to talk about it. So, and you know, over such a longer period of time, so I think it's fantastic.
It started the process. It's not an issue with abortion. It's a complicated series of issues. We've talked about some of them. Thank you, Leslie.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you, Lynn.
Thank you, Adam.
We'll be back next week. Next week on Allegro Non Troppo, we're going to look and we're going to celebrate gay and lesbian stereotypes.
Look forward to that.
See you next week, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Allegro Non Troppo. Remember, it's not what you think, it's what I think.